Good morning or afternoon, everyone, and welcome to EMForum.org. I am Amy Sebring and will serve as your host and moderator today, and we are very glad you could join us. We will be providing some instructions as we go along so you can relax and participate with us. As you are probably well aware, the official beginning of hurricane season is almost upon us, and as we have done in the past, we have invited the National Hurricane Center to brief us on what's new this year. Please note there is a link on today's background page to the complete update for 2014, but our program today will focus on the storm surge forecasting. First, for the benefit of any first-timers, we will begin with an overview presentation, and then we will proceed with your questions or comments. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we ask you not to submit your question or comment until we do get to that part of the program. You may wish to jot down any questions that you may have as we go along. Today's recordings and a copy of the slides will be available from our site later this afternoon, and a transcript will be available early next week. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce today's special guest. Robbie Berg serves as hurricane specialist at the National Hurricane Center in Miami, where his work involves the issuance of track, intensity, and wind radii forecasts, as well as associated watches and warnings for tropical cyclones in the Atlantic and eastern North Pacific Ocean basins. Please do see today's background page for further biographical details and links to related resources, as I mentioned. Welcome, Robbie, and thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. I now turn the floor over to you to start us off, please.
Okay, thanks, Amy. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you fine. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So I want to thank everyone for allowing me to give this talk today about storm surge forecasting at the National Hurricane Center. The way the talk's going to go is I'm going to go a little bit first into storm surge forecasting in general, some of the older products that we use, and then towards the end of the talk, we'll get into some of the new stuff coming along the way, some of which is experimental beginning this year. So to begin, let's just jump right into how do we actually model storm surge. Well, first off, there's different ways we can tackle the problem. First off, you can look at statistical methods, but the problem with statistical methods is that they do use only historical data. And a lot of times that data is non-existent. In other words, we've had hurricanes make landfall in the United States, but not every location along the coast has been hit, let's say, by a Category 4 hurricane. So we can't use that, the historical data, to extrapolate what kind of storm surge we might get at any location along the coast. So really, this method isn't very helpful for us when we're actually doing forecasting. The second way we could do it is by looking at what we call deterministic numerical models. This is based on forecasting storm surge solely based on physical equations of how things move. In other words, how does the wind from the hurricane push water along? This type of forecasting is strongly dependent on accurate meteorological input. In other words, how accurate is the actual hurricane forecast coming from the Hurricane Center? Unfortunately, that because of the uncertainty in tropical cyclone forecasts, we know that our forecasts aren't perfect. This particular method can be inaccurate, and I'll have a great example to show you coming up on why we can't use this particular method. So if we can't use that, what do we use? Well, we like to use what we call numerical model ensembles, and this essentially is looking at many different runs of the same model, but with different conditions. In other words, like a family of storms. This is the best approach for determining storm surge risk and vulnerability for an area, since it does account for forecast uncertainty. And again, we'll have some illustrations coming up that will show this in a more vivid description. So what do we use at the Hurricane Center and within the National Weather Service for forecasting storm surge? Well, our model that we use is called SLOSH. It is an acronym that means sea, lake, and overland surges from hurricanes. This is a model that was developed by the National Weather Service several decades ago, probably back in the 1970s, and it is used to estimate storm surge height resulting from historical, hypothetical, or predicted hurricanes. Now, one thing you should know is that Slosh, is, even though it's old, it's an older model, it is pretty good at what it does, and it does include a lot of things that you might be concerned about. So it knows about slow water flow through barriers, gaps, and passes along the coast. It knows that those passes can be deep between different bodies of water. It knows about inland inundation, or wetting and drying of cells, as we call it. In other words, there are some storm surge models that will raise the water level along the coast, but they won't actually bring that coast or bring that water inland in areas that are normally dry. But the Slosh model is able to do that, so it can take normally dry areas along the coast and make them wet from the storm surge. It can overtop barrier systems, levees, and roads. It can account for astronomical tides. Unfortunately, two important factors that Slosh does not include, which are not storm surge related, are breaking waves along the coast and the normal river flow and rain. So while Slosh cannot account for those two parameters by itself, the Weather Service does have other ways around that. And in addition to that, we're doing putting a lot of research into trying to incorporate those parameters into the storm surge forecast and allowing Slosh to be able to see those things within its model simulations. So we're not there yet. It is currently one of the challenges we're working on, and we hope that within the next 5 to 10 years we will be able to include breaking waves and river flow in the Slosh model itself. So the way Slosh is arranged is that you actually run the model in a grid or a Slosh grid, and what you see on your screen are the many different grids along the coast that we can choose from. So in a real-time storm, we're only going to choose those grids which are going to be affected by the storm. And what that does is it cuts down on the runtime that's required to run the storm surge simulation. If we had to actually run the simulation through every one of those grids, it would slow the whole process down. And when we're actually making a forecast, we need information very quickly. So in order to cut down that runtime, we only focus on those areas that are at risk from the surge and the hurricane itself. Now, we know that there's been some talk about how does Slosh, even though it's old, how does it compare to other higher resolution, higher performing storm surge models? And one of those models is called ADCERC. Now, ADCERC has its pluses, and we don't like to say that we don't like ADCERC. It's just that we don't think it's really useful for our operations. And one of the reasons is that because ADCERC is such a high resolution model, they take a long time to run. And if you remember before, I was talking about how we need to run a family of storms when we're looking at simulations, not just one run. So with Slosh, we can run one storm through that model within minutes on a desktop computer. ADCERC, on the other hand, takes a supercomputer, a much higher performing computer, and it would take that one storm maybe up to several hours to run. So if you're thinking about running a family of storms, we just don't have the luxury to wait that amount of time to get a storm run through the ADCERC model. So that's one of the main reasons that we've stuck with Slosh, because it is a very fast model that gets us the information that we need in a quick amount of time. One thing I would note, too, that you can see on your screen is that if we take the same storm and run it through both models, you notice that the flooding pattern really isn't that much different between the Slosh and the ADCERC runs. So you could probably zoom in really close and see some differences, but in an overall community-wide sense, you're still seeing the same types of flooding in both models. So in some sense, the resolution of the model can only get so high for our purposes when it comes to operational real-time forecasting. So to sum up about how we've actually forecast storm surge, I think this point is one that you really need to take away, is that all storm surge models, no matter how high resolution they are strongly dependent on the accuracy of the meteorological input. If the hurricane forecast itself is wrong by any little bit, whether it be the track or the intensity or the size of the storm, that's going to have huge implications on how well the storm surge model runs and what type of flooding pattern you may see. The meteorological uncertainty in that hurricane forecast will always dominate over the storm surge model specifications themselves, and that includes the physics, the resolution, and other sorts of parameters. We won't get into vertical datum, it's not important here. In reality, storm surge is only one component in the real water level rise during a storm. I kind of touched on this already. Really, if you live along the coast, you're worried about how high is the water going to rise from this storm? And that includes the components of the storm surge, the tides, the waves, and the freshwater flow. So as I was already describing, the SLOSH model does a good job with the surge and the tides. We have other models that can forecast the wave action along the coast and another model that does the river stages, but right now all three of those models don't really talk to each other very well. So as I already mentioned, that some of the research that's going into right now is trying to figure out how we can make those models talk to one another so that in the end what we're really getting is the total water level rise. Fortunately, in most scenarios, it's really just the surge and tide that are the biggest contributors to the water level rise. So while we're not explicitly including the other two factors, in most cases, those are not the two that are most important. So I was talking about an example to illustrate why the family of storms is so important. So let's take a look here. This is a case where we have a hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico to the southeast of Louisiana. And you can see from the black line, this would be the actual forecast track given by the National Hurricane Center. And then in the white, you see what would be called the cone of uncertainty. And in this case, we have the storm to the southeast Louisiana, and the 12-hour forecast point is right along the northern Gulf Coast, just to the west of Mobile Bay. So keep that in mind. We're only talking 12 hours out from a potential landfall. That's a very short amount of time. If we were to take that forecast from that storm and run it through the SLOSH model, this is the flooding footprint you would get. So now you're seeing that you're getting a lot of flooding in Mobile Bay, in the Barrier Islands to the south of Mobile Bay, and we're seeing values close to 12 to 14 feet above this datum, NGVD 29. Now look in the same figure, look further to the east, and you see in Pensacola, you're not getting nearly as much flooding in that area as you are in the Mobile area. You're still seeing some, maybe about 2 feet or so, but in reality, it's not as significant as you might be seeing to the farther to the west. So the question to you is, here's our forecast. We're only 12 hours from a potential landfall. Is this the type of guidance that you would want to see to really analyze your true risk from this storm? Well, here's what actually happened with this storm. So it continued moving to the north, and although the black line was that 12-hour forecast, the storm made a slight shift to the right, or to the east. This is not a huge shift. This is a pretty good forecast. You're only looking at about 30 miles to the east of the 12-hour forecast point. But instead of making a landfall to the west of Mobile Bay, now we're actually making a landfall to the east of Mobile Bay. So if this is what the storm actually did, what do you think the storm surge flooding actually occurred with this storm? So now we can take that track and put it in the SLOSH model, and here's what you get. So now you know it's a big difference in the flooding footprint. Now, Mobile Bay, instead of having all those winds pushing water into the bay, you have the winds blowing offshore and blowing winds out of Mobile Bay. So instead of seeing the 12 to 14 feet of surge, now you're seeing more like about 4 feet of surge. In the meantime, look to the east in Pensacola. If you remember from the previous diagram, we showed about 2 feet of surge. Now, all of a sudden, in some parts of the bay there near Pensacola, you're looking at about 10 to 12 feet of surge. So there's two things going on here. One is that the track shifted a little bit to the east. In addition, the size of the storm grew more than was actually forecast. So a little secret is that when it comes to hurricane forecasting, we're pretty good at track, we're so-so with intensity, and we're not really good at all when it comes to size forecasting. So that's one of those parameters you really have to factor in the uncertainty to a large extent. And what happened in this particular storm is that the storm did grow just in that 12-hour time frame, and the strongest winds extended further out away from the actual track. So we pushed a lot more water into the Pensacola area. And with this storm evolution, this is the type of flooding we got. So you can see it's a lot different from what was originally contained in that initial 12-hour forecast. So we can't have this sort of scenario occurring, so we have to figure out a way to actually, again, analyze the true risk and vulnerability to the surge of any particular storm. So there are perils of not accounting for uncertainty, and I like to use this diagram because I think it shows what happens if you don't account for the uncertainty in a hurricane forecast. You're essentially putting all of your eggs into one basket. And if something was to go wrong, if the track was to shift just a little bit, if the intensity was to go up a little bit, if the size was to increase a little bit in the storm, you could end up looking like this. You put all your eggs in one basket, and you've made a really bad decision ahead of the storm. So we have to use the ensemble approaches in order to analyze our true risk. So how do we do that? Well, several ways. We want to look at an alternative to single runs. And one way is to look at an atlas of pre-computed storm surge maps that are based on different directions of motion of the storm, different landfall locations, different intensities, different storm sizes, different forward speeds. And the way we can do that is to look at these three different products, and I'll go through each of these one by one. First off are the MEAOs, or maximum envelopes of water, the MOMS, which are the maximum of the MEAOs, and then there are the real-time simulations, which are the probabilistic storm surge product. So let's start with the MEAOs, or the maximum envelope of water. So essentially with a MEAO, if you have the Slosh display program, these MEAOs are already available to you right now if you were to open up the program and look for your area. And what happens with the MEAO is that you actually select as the user the Saffir-Simpson category of the storm, the forward speed, storm direction, and the tide anomaly. The radius of maximum winds and the landfall location are already built into this particular product. The best way to show this is to actually show you an example of a MEAO and how it's created. So here's a simulation of a storm. You can see on the bottom of this figure there's a black line moving in somewhere near the Charleston, South Carolina area. So that's one storm. And when I take that one storm and I run it through the Slosh model in this particular grid, you'll notice you get this type of flooding. So what I want you to notice is that there's a grid cell marked here somewhere up in southern North Carolina. It says 4.8 feet. So from that one storm, it produced 4.8 feet at that one location. And you'll notice that I selected a Category 3 storm moving to the west-northwest at 15 miles per hour at high tide. Well, let's say that we're not so sure that the storm's going to make landfall at exactly that location. So what if it moved to the north a bit and made landfall there? Move it up the coast. And then what if we had another storm and it moved and made landfall further up the coast? And we kept doing that. And you'll notice as I add storms, the flooding changes based on that particular storm. Also notice that in our inset, let me go back here, that the values are changing as that storm gets closer. So as the storm gets closer, you would expect a higher surge at that particular cell. Well, what if I had all of these family of storms and I said, well, let's just hit the coast everywhere with any particular storm with those parameters, so the Category 3 moving to the west-northwest at 15 miles per hour at high tide. Well, now what I do is that I retain the highest value at that grid cell from any one of those storms. And in this particular case, it was 13.8 feet. So the MEAO for that particular location with those parameters was 13.8 feet. Now, this is one particular MEAO, and for any basin, you can get tens to hundreds of MEAO depending on the different parameters and how you choose them. One thing about the MEAO is that what you're seeing on your screen shows flooding, but this isn't the actual flooding that would occur from that particular storm because we're looking at a family of storms. So this is more or less like the worst case scenario for a storm given those particular characteristics. Now, thinking about what a MEAO is, we can go even further and say, well, what if we want to know what the maximum of the MEAOs are? Or the MOM. So we'll go back to our MEAO. This is the one I just showed. Now with the MOM, what happens is you only select the category. All of those other parameters are baked into the cake for you. So I took that same MEAO I used, and it showed me 13.8 feet at that location in southern North Carolina. But now what happens, let's say I say, okay, well, what if the storm makes landfall at different directions into the coast? Using those same parameters of a Category 3 storm. Also, what if the speed changes? Or what if the tide level is different? So after I've hit the coast in all different directions, I still retain the highest value within that particular cell. And now you can see that I have a MOM, a Category 3 MOM, showing 14.7 feet at that location in southern North Carolina. So this is taking all the different uncertainty that exists with a particular storm or event and composites them to show you what the actual risk is along the coast from that category of storms. Now, the MOMS are important because that's the product that actually goes into determining evacuation zones along the coast of the United States. So, in other words, a Category 3 storm in this particular part of the country has the potential to do this sort of flooding along the coast. And because of that simulation, that output is used to determine what type of evacuation should be called for a Category 3 storm threatening the coast of North Carolina and South Carolina in this particular case. So, again, it's important for you to know about the MOMS and that they are the basis for the nation's evacuation zones anywhere from Texas up to Maine. Here's an example of what I'm talking about. If you take a look at this figure from New York City, these are the evacuation zones from the city. And what I want you to notice is I'm going to toggle between the evacuation zones, and here what I'm showing is the Category 4 MOM. So you can see that any Category 4 storm could potentially produce this type of flooding in New York City. Now watch again how the two phase in and how the evacuation zones line up very close to the Category 4 MOMs. And that's not by coincidence. Again, it's because those MOMs are being used to create the evacuation zones along the coast. So I just want to show an illustration of how that actually occurs and how municipalities and states actually use that data to create their zones. And again, there's the two over top on one another. The black lines would be the Category 4 MOM, and the colors would be the evacuation zones for the city. Now, all of those products I just showed, the MOMs and YEOWs, again, are available to you right now. So you can go into the SLOSH display program, and you can actually look at them. But when we're in an actual event, at some time, we actually will start producing what's called the probabilistic storm surge product. And this is what it is. So it's based on the official National Hurricane Center advisory. So we've produced a forecast. Let's say an advisory goes out at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. And based on that forecast, we will run these probabilities and create a storm surge forecast. It's available roughly 48 hours prior to the arrival of tropical storm force winds along the coast. And another way of looking at that is it's when we have a watcher warning in effect for the United States coastline. The P-Surge product is beneficial because it actually does account for meteorological uncertainty in the hurricane forecast. So it accounts for track and landfall location uncertainty. It accounts for uncertainties in the size of the storm. It accounts for uncertainties in the forward speed of the storm and uncertainties in the intensity of the storm. And these uncertainties are based on historical errors that we've had in our hurricane forecast. So we keep a very good running verification of how good or bad our forecasts are. And we actually use the past 5 years of our forecast to determine our historical errors, and those errors are then input into the P-Surge product. The latest version, version 2.0, which will be available this coming hurricane season, also does account for tide and can be available above ground level. So that's very important because in the past, the original version of P-Surge did not account for tide. So if you were looking at the P-Surge guidance, you actually had to somehow find a way to add the tide into that guidance. And if you weren't looking at the same vertical datums, then you essentially could screw up the whole process. So this is a big improvement to the model because now the tide's accounted for, you don't have to manually add the tide to what you're seeing in the output. And also, as I said, the product is going to be above ground level as well, in addition to above the normal datum, which is typically NABD 88. So here's an illustration of how P-Surge works. So here we have a storm. This happened to be Hurricane Irene from a couple of years ago. It was sitting to the east of Florida, just to the north of the Bahamas. Here was the actual forecast from the Hurricane Center in the black line. So we had a forecast landfall somewhere in eastern North Carolina, then riding up the mid-Atlantic coast into New England. But we know that the forecast isn't perfect. So we have to assume that the track could shift a little bit to the east, or the track could shift a little bit to the west. In addition, we have to assume that the size could vary a bit. So we know that hurricanes come in all different sizes, and even though we forecast a particular size, that size can change. So we have to look at small, medium, and large storms. We have to assume that the speed is a little bit faster or a little bit slower than we're actually forecasting. And we have to assume that the storm either gets a little bit stronger or a little bit weaker than we're forecasting. But the thing to remember is that in PSearch, all of these differences are centered around the official forecast. So it's not like we're throwing out the forecast, but it's all actually centered and weighted heavily along the official forecast. Once you've run PSearch, this is the type of output you would receive. So this is actually an example shot from Hurricane Sandy in 2012. And you'll notice that PSearch did a very good job of illustrating the areas along the coast that had the highest risk from the storm surge from Sandy. And in fact, the coast of New Jersey, Long Island, New York, and Long Island Sound, including the Connecticut coast, was ground zero for the highest storm surge. So it did realistically paint the areas that had the highest risk from the worst surge. So remember the example I showed earlier in the presentation. Let's go back to that one. So here's our storm. There's the forecast, the original forecast, showing it making landfall to the west of Mobile Bay, where we had a lot of flooding possible in Mobile Bay and not quite as much in Pensacola. So the deterministic flash run showed a limited surge threat to Pensacola. Well, let's look at this now and say, well, in this event, we're only 12 hours away from landfall, so we have likely hurricane warnings in effect, which means PSearch would be available. So let's look at what the PSearch output would have shown for this storm. And here you go. So what I'm showing here is the probability that the surge would be greater than 8 feet, which is a significant level. So now you can see that the PSearch product was showing at least a 60% chance of 8 feet of surge in Mobile Bay, which makes sense based on the forecast. But it's also showing at least a 50% chance of 8 feet of surge in parts of Pensacola. So the PSearch product is realistically taking into account the uncertainties in the forecast, and it's assuming that some of those tracks could shift to the east, bringing the storm closer to Pensacola, or it's assuming that the storm could grow in size more than what was actually in the forecast. And when it took those uncertainties into account, it did realistically show that there was a significant storm surge risk in the Pensacola area as well as the Mobile Bay area. So during an event, realistically, somebody making a critical decision on things such as evacuations should be looking at a product like this and saying, well, it doesn't matter if I'm in Mobile or Pensacola, I should probably be making a very similar decision, which would be to evacuate people away from the coastline because there's just that amount of risk to surge from this particular storm. And here is, in reality, what happened. So the storm did, as I said, shift it to the east. It created that higher storm surge in the Pensacola area. And this is a true, this is a real storm. This was Hurricane Ivan from 2004. So this isn't something that we made up. This is an actual storm that occurred and where critical decisions had to be made based on that forecast. And this is just showing why or how using PSearch can help immensely when having to make those critical decisions. So I've thrown three different products at you, the MOMS, the MIAS, and the PSearch, and we like to show what we call the storm surge decision support wedge so that you kind of get a good understanding of what you should be looking at different points along the forecast. So if you start at the bottom of the wedge in Tier 3, this is your planning and mitigation stage. So this is where we're looking more than 5 days from a landfall, looking now where there's not even a storm out there, it's before hurricane season. You're planning for hurricane season. So at this point, you should be looking at your MOMS. And that makes sense because, as I told you before, the MOMS are used to create your evacuation zones. So when you're well away from a landfall, you're more than 5 days out, there's not even a storm there, look at your MOMS to really assess your risk along the coast. Now, as you get within about 2 to 5 days of a potential landfall, now you're in your readiness stage. I would still suggest looking at your MOMS, but now that since you have a forecast from the Hurricane Center showing a storm approaching your area, you can start to refine some of the parameters associated with that storm, and you can start looking at specific MIAs because you may be able to pick a particular category, and you may also be able to eliminate some of the different directions that could be available to you. Maybe you know that the storm would either move to the northwest, the north, or the northeast, but not necessarily to the south. So you can start to eliminate some of the possibilities and look at specific MIAs to further refine your assessment of your risk. Now, when you get within 48 hours of a landfall, within that watch warning time frame, you're in the response phase. So we still recommend looking at your meows, doing further refinements to figure out which ones are best to look at. But at this stage, the probabilistic storm surge is now available to you in a real-time sense so that you can get a better handle on the risk from that storm. In addition to those products, though, you'll also start receiving actual explicit numbers from the Hurricane Center within our advisories and also within the local statements provided by the National Weather Service forecast offices along the coast. So you can see that as we get closer to the landfall, everything starts converging to more refined information. It's just that when you're more than about 2 days out, there's still too much uncertainty within the forecast to be able to provide specific and extremely accurate information. So those are the products that have been available to people now for several years. But let's look into the future and where we're going, especially coming up this current hurricane season. And for that, we're going to start with what we call the Experimental Potential Storm Surge Flooding Map, or sometimes you may have heard it being called the Inundation Map. So add some background to this graphic. The first question we get is, which product will drive the inundation graphic? And it's going to be P-Surge. In fact, P-Surge 2.0, which is coming online this year, so it does include the tides. One thing I didn't mention about P-Surge is that you actually will select the level that you're concerned with. For this inundation graphic, we are going to select the 10% exceed. And what that means is it's a good way of looking at what you should plan for this storm. To put it in context, if you were to look at a 0% exceedance, that would be like looking at a worst-case scenario. Nothing could potentially top what you're seeing in a 0% exceedance. But the problem with using a 0% exceedance is that you would end up over-evacuating people in a potential event. So we don't want to over-evacuate. If I was to look at a 50% exceedance product, essentially what I'm saying is that I have a coin flip, that there's a 50-50 chance that the level that's being shown on that map might be higher or it might be lower. And when it comes to critical decisions on things like storm surge, which can be a life-threatening hazard, we don't have the luxury to do a 50-50 coin flip. So we really have to exclude and not account for that 50% exceedance. So for that reason, we use the 10% exceedance. And really what it means is that there's only a 10% chance that the values shown on the graphic will be exceeded by the real storm. So it's not a worst-case scenario, but it's a plausible upper bound of what could happen. And as I kind of already mentioned, it's what we suggest you should plan for in a storm, given the uncertainties in the forecast. The grids that are used for this product are from the latest slosh basin updates, which have been updated to NABD 88, which is the newest datum. Topography-wise, we're using a Coastal Services Center Sea Level Rise DEM. So they've been producing this topography data set to do sea level rise studies, but it's being done in a timely fashion that we can actually use it as well for our inundation graphic. It is such a high resolution, though, that we have had to do some resampling to make it a little bit smoother resolution. Because when some of the polling and focus groups we've done showed that when it was too high resolution, some people actually thought it was not accurate. So by doing a little bit of smoothing, we're able to make the figure look a little bit more attractive to people when they're looking at it, and they put a little bit more faith into what they're looking at. In some areas where they haven't finished this DEM, we have been augmenting it with USGS NED data, but that is being phased out as we go along for the higher resolution data. Processing-wise, we're locally using ArcGIS for server and desktop, but we are working towards leveraging National Weather Service program, or the IVP, which in the coming years, hopefully once they get that spun up, we won't have to do this locally. It will be done within the larger National Weather Service framework. So here's an example. One of the things we have to do in order to create this is we have to merge all of those grids that I showed you earlier in the talk. So this is an example of the merged grid, and on top of that, you can also see the topography data that we're using to create this inundation graphic. So inundation, you can only actually calculate inundation if you know how high the land is. So the storm surge model produces a storm surge height. You know how high the land is at any location, and you can just do a subtraction to get how much water is actually sitting on dry land. So that's why we need that high-resolution data. And you can see from this map that we do include that data for every area along the coastline from Texas all the way up to Maine. So in a simplistic fashion, this is what it looks like. This would be a raw output from the peak surge guidance. So we get a grid of data showing storm surge heights at different locations, and the post-processing that we do transforms that data into the inundation graphic or the potential storm surge flooding graphic. So many of you on the webinar may have seen this example. This is an example of a simulated storm that we've done in the Fort Myers, Florida area. And it's just showing you potential storm surge flooding that might occur from a simulated storm, with the higher values in red decreasing as you go further inland to the lower values shown in blue. And this is what the prototype looks like. So again, this is the Fort Myers area. The red would be extreme, or 9 feet or greater of inundation or storm surge flooding above ground level. Orange is designated as high, or 6 to 9 feet. Moderate would be 3 to 6 feet, and low would be 3 feet or less. Now, how is this useful? Well, I haven't mentioned yet, but this is only in an experimental phase this year, and because it's in an experimental phase, we won't actually be disseminating the raw data in any sort of format like a GIS shapefile. But we do think that in the coming years, once we go operational with this product, it will be useful when it comes to making important decisions. Here's an example of, again, looking at Southwest Florida in the Fort Myers area. These are the evacuation zones that they have in that area, starting with T, which would stand for tropical storm, and then A, B, and C. And I think they actually do have a D and maybe E, but they're not shown on this particular diagram. What is interesting, and what we think that the potential for this product is that you'll notice as I flip back and forth, I can take this inundation graphic from this particular storm and overlay it on top of my evacuation zones to really determine which zones are most vulnerable from the storm surge in this particular storm, and then I can make a more educated decision on which zones should be evacuated. So in this particular case, we know that we definitely evacuate zone T, we would definitely evacuate zone A, we would definitely evacuate zone B, and zone C could be up for debate. There's a lot of areas here in this kind of light pink color that aren't quite touched by the water being moved inland by the storm in this particular scenario. So there could be argument for zone C to not have to be evacuated, at least not fully evacuated. So again, in a real-time scenario, we think that this particular product will go a long way into helping emergency managers make those critical decisions as far as evacuation. And it can go beyond that. It could go into things like looking at shelters. Are there shelters located in areas that could be under potential flooding from this particular storm? Other critical facilities such as hospitals. You can look at transportation routes. Which roads are at risk of being inundated by storm surge from this particular storm? So again, we think this particular product has great potential going forward into helping to make some of those critical decisions both before a storm and then as that storm is beginning to make landfall, so we can get ready for the response phase after the storm. And here are some other examples. We have four actual examples that we've produced leading into the hurricane season. There was the Fort Myers example I showed. This is one from the Houston area, Galveston. Again, you can see the legend there, potential storm surge flooding with four categories. Blue up to red. And from this, again, is a simulated storm. This is not actually Hurricane Ike. This was another simulated storm that we created, but it does show that there are some areas that are more susceptible to storm surge flooding because the flooding penetrates further inland than in other areas. So to the north of Galveston Bay, there's a lot of potential for storm surge penetrating well inland, even up to I-10 in this particular scenario. And then showing down further south the potential flooding in the Galveston area. Here's an example from Charleston, South Carolina. Again, this is not Hurricane Hugo. This is just another storm that we generated as a simulation. But you can see that it realistically shows that the worst surge could occur along the barrier islands and in the back bays of those islands especially out here closer to the ocean. But in addition, it shows that that surge can get up into all of those creeks and other waterways that extend outward away from the Charleston area. And the last example that we produced is the New York City area. Just like the others, this is not Hurricane Sandy or Hurricane Irene. This is just another example of a simulation that we ran. But it does show the areas that would be potentially at risk from surge. So we have the areas along the shore of Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and then over onto the Jersey side, including areas like Hoboken, Jersey City, and then even further inland into the Meadowlands. So you can notice from these diagrams that the inundation graphic knows where higher land is. So if you're familiar with the New York City, New Jersey area, you know that there's a bit of land here extending down through Hoboken and Jersey City that's elevated. So it's not going to inundate those areas because it knows that the land is higher. But in the meantime, it does know that in the Meadowlands to the west of that area is very low-lying, it's very marshy, and so it does allow the storm surge to get up into those areas, and you can see the types of flooding that could have occurred from that particular storm. So the takeaways for this product are that it will be available during this coming hurricane season on an experimental basis via the National Hurricane Center website. And again, what the experimental phase means is that we can't guarantee that the product will always be available. The experimental phase is for us to work out the kinks with this particular product before we go live in an operational sense. So there could be times where we just can't get it up during an event. But we want to make it available to people so that they can actually look at it during an event when it's available and to assess how useful it might be to them or if there's any changes that we should make before going operational. For that very reason as well, there will be no data dissemination during this phase. In other words, we won't be disseminating the data in a raw sense, like in a GIS shapefile. It will only be available via the Hurricane Center website in a Google-type format where you can pan and zoom in into your area. The last thing I want to talk about is, real briefly, I don't have as much to talk about on this particular topic because this is in the coming years, but it's a storm surge watch and warning. The National Weather Service has decided that, based on some recent storms we've had, that we really need to go move forward with initiating storm surge watches and warnings. If you look at the hazards associated with a hurricane, there are four main hazards. There's the wind hazard, there's the storm surge hazard, there's the freshwater flooding and rainfall hazard, and there's the tornado hazard. And if you look at which of those hazards we actually warn for, we warn for the wind in a hurricane warning. By definition, a hurricane warning means that hurricane force winds are expected in that area. We warn for river flooding and flash flooding from rainfall, and we warn for tornadoes with tornado warnings. But the National Weather Service does not have an explicit warning for storm surge. And there's a problem there because storm surge has been shown to take the most number of lives in tropical cyclones. I think you only have to look back at storms like Katrina and Ike and Sandy to see that the storm surge in a lot of cases is the hazard that takes the most number of lives. So because of these more recent storms, we've noticed that there is a gap in our warning scheme. And so the Weather Service has agreed and decided that we're going to move forward with this. Now, this is something that we're looking to go experimental with in 2015, so not this coming hurricane season. This is what we're looking at for the next hurricane season. And one thing you might notice based on the diagram I have shown on the screen is that the storm surge warning would be a little bit different from other warnings you've received in the past. In the past, you receive a warning based on a county scale. So you might see something like hurricane warning is in effect for, let's say, Miami-Dade County here in South Florida. That would cover the entire county. Some warnings are done in a fashion like tornado warnings, where a polygon is issued by the National Weather Service, and you know if you're in the warning whether or not you actually reside within that polygon. The problem is that those methods aren't really useful when it comes to storm surge. We can't use the county-based method because storm surge, in many cases, only stays right along the media coastline. Even in areas where it does penetrate further inland, it's not going to cover an entire county. So it doesn't make sense for us to issue a county-based storm surge warning because then we'd be over-warning more area than we really should be. So the way we think the Weather Service is going to go with this is to use the NDFD grids, which are used to make the actual forecast. You can see in this particular diagram why it looks kind of boxy is because it's using those grids within that data set. But what you'll notice is that in this particular case, this would be a Hurricane Irene example. The area that is painted under the storm surge warning is the area that is at risk of potentially life-threatening storm surge. So we're limited to areas right along the coast, along the Barrier Islands, and then even along the shores of the Sound, the Pamlico and Albemarle Sounds in eastern North Carolina. So it does a much better job of truly painting the areas that are at risk for that life-threatening storm surge. The storm surge warning itself, a lot still has to be determined within the Weather Service as far as criteria, the official definition of the warning. But I think we're pretty sure that we really only want to paint those areas that we think are under life-threatening storm surge risk. So we won't be issuing a storm surge warning for any little flooding that might occur along the coast. We're probably looking at thresholds of about 3 to 4 feet of inundation, which for most people would be up to about their waist. And then for many kids are only about 3 to 4 feet high, so in those cases it would be life-threatening for them. So again, still a lot has to be decided on this internally within the Weather Service, how we're going to move forward. It will be a collaborative process, so it won't just be coming from the National Hurricane Center. We will be working with the local National Weather Service forecast offices to create this particular storm surge warning. It will be a collaborative process coming from both offices jointly during a storm. So I think that's all I have. Yeah, that's my last slide. Again, just to reiterate, the experimental potential storm surge flooding map will be available this coming hurricane season. It will be available on our website when there is a watch or warning in effect for the United States. And again, because it's experimental, there will be no native data dissemination. For the storm surge watch and warning that you see on the screen now, this is looking at more like a 2015 experimental product. And in that sense, it'll be the same sort of ground rules. Being in experimental phase may not always be available. We're still going to work kinks out. But then after a year or two of testing, hopefully this would be something that would go operational as we get closer to, say, 2017, 2018. So with that, I'm finished, and I can take questions.
Thank you very much, Robbie. That was very thorough. Folks, to ask a question or make a comment, just type into the chat panel and click on send, and then I will read the questions or comments aloud, and our guests will respond via the bridge. Please keep your question or comment related to today's topic, of course, and reasonably concise. And we are ready to begin now, and we do have some questions already. The first one I have, Robbie, is, I have to get back to it, John Callahan asks, is the P surge based on the slosh model runs?
Yes, it is. So what happens in P surge is that the slosh model is actually run for all of those different families of storms that are centered around the official forecast. So the slosh model is the base model for P surge.
Great. And I think we kind of figured that was probably the case. But this P-Surge, is that a program that's just available to the National Hurricane Center, or is that something that will be available to, you know, emergency management people in the future, perhaps?
That has actually been available on our website for people during a storm for several years now. And it's available in a Google-esque type of framework where you can pan and zoom. But that product is actually available also in GIS shapefile. So emergency managers and others can take that information, download it, and use it as they see fit. The one thing I didn't really go into in depth with that, though, is that you do select the different levels that you're interested in. So I think for the height of a storm surge, I think the levels go from 2 up to like 21 feet. So based on what you're interested in, you would select the level, and then it would give you percentages or the chance that the storm surge would reach that level all along the coast. So it is available now. It has been available for a couple of years. And whenever there is a watch or warning in effect for the United States, that's when you would be able to see it on the National Hurricane Center website.
But you can actually run it or just get the data? I guess I'm not.
Yeah, you're not running anything. It's already been run on the supercomputer by the National Weather Service. So what you're looking at is the output from that model run.
Right, but and my question went to, will people in the future be able to actually have access to the model itself, not just the data?
So you talk about Flosh or PSurge?
PSurge. I know. We already have.
Well, PSurge isn't a model. It's running off of Flosh, which is the model itself.
Okay.
And people can download the Flosh display program. That's available to you now. You can look at the moms and meows, which I went over. You cannot look at PSurge in the Flosh display program because that's a real-time type of product. But the Flosh display program itself is available to emergency managers to download and use.
Yes, exactly right. And on the inundation map, do you update that PSurge and the inundation map with each advisory?
Yes, that's a very good question. So it's updated every 6 hours with the new forecast. So you could see some changes from forecast to forecast, although since for the inundation graphic, since we're using a 10% exceedance, we're already kind of looking at the upper bound of possibilities. You shouldn't see too many major changes from forecast to forecast. But that is an excellent question, in that it will be available every 6 hours with the new issuance of a hurricane forecast.
Okay, very good. I've got a couple questions from Peter Slavinsky from the Maine Geological Survey. And you touched or mentioned in passing getting some feedback from folks on these. He asked, has there been feedback regarding the proposed these storm surge depth color schemes? Intuitively, I think of darker colors as deeper areas of inundation. Existing color scheme seems to correlate well with greater risk of storm surge, not necessarily inundation depth.
Okay, I guess I don't quite understand the question, because the storm surge is what's creating the inundation depths. So the highest depths are in red, which means more danger. I should provide some background into the development of this product. There was a very large social science outreach campaign to in the marketing of this particular product. So we didn't just sit back in our office and create this product ourselves. We actually contracted out with several social scientists who went out and produced surveys. So they surveyed emergency managers, the media, other weather service employees, the public. They also conducted focus groups with these different audience members. And we went through many iterations of developing this particular graphic based on the feedback we got from all those different groups. As you can imagine, because each group has its particular wants and needs, it's very hard to create one product that will totally fit and satisfy everyone's needs. But based on the overwhelming evidence we got from these focus groups and surveys, this was the final result that we got. As far as the colors goes, we tested a whole bunch of different color schemes, whether just sticking with one color blue with different shadings. We looked at different colors going from the blue to the red, as I was showing you, to other different color schemes like green to red and vice versa. And what you see is what kind of bubbled up to the top as what was most liked and most interpreted correctly by the greatest number of people.
Well, you definitely had a lot of input on that issue. So.
Yes,
his second question is, let me get back to it. Every time somebody puts in a new question, my screen jumps. One moment. Okay, a second question was, does the inundation depth outputs take into account inherent model error, parentheses, and what is error of PSurge? Flosh was supposedly 20%. So I presume if Flosh is 20, then the PSurge would be 20. But
That's a very that's just a complex question because first off, the number that had been quoted historically about Flosh being accurate to within 20% is a little broad, and it's hard to actually extrapolate that to how things are now. I don't have time to show you any of this, but we have been doing some recent studies looking at how Flosh performed in the New York area from Sandy, and we actually had some really good results. I mean, and I would say that the errors were comparing it to tide gauges, another data we had, I think it would be less than 20%, actually. What was the other part of that question? I'm sorry.
I think he's just trying to get a sense of the model error.
So the accuracy. Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know how accurate the 20% is now, but whatever model inaccuracies are in the slosh itself, since that's the base for both P-Surge and the inundation graphic, that's the type of inaccuracy you might get. But I would suspect, though, that the 20% that's been quoted historically has gotten a lot better, especially since we've made the model much higher resolution than we did 10, 20 years ago.
All right, I have a question from Chris Ludwig, who says, thanks for the great and informative presentation. I may have missed this, but how are changes in elevation implemented into MOM Meow calculations? For example, is the DEM revised to include new elevation data after major storms like Sandy?
Yeah, good, very good question. So what happens here at the Hurricane Center is that every year we update a handful of basins. If you remember the basins I showed you, and there's different ways that those are chosen about which ones are updated, whether they be the ones that haven't been updated in a while, or if a storm occurred in a basin and there have been changes to the coastline. So those basins are updated based on any kind of new data that we receive, and a lot of that's the new LIDAR data that's being taken from the coastline. So in a sense, we're kind of at the mercy of the states who actually collect that new LIDAR data. If the state hasn't collected the data, and then we don't have new data to update the model or the basins. So it all kind of depends on the states that have invested in updating that data and whether or not their basins get updated in subsequent years.
Very good. We're about running out of time, folks. I have one more question from John Callahan that we can get to, who asks, are there plans within the National Weather Service for similar products for extratropical storms like nor'easters?
Very good question. So the short answer is yes. We recognize that the extratropical storms, nor'easters, also produce storm surge events, some of them quite significant. The way that the Weather Service is tackling this right now is because it would be that we're trying to finish up with the tropical stuff first, so finishing up with what I've shown you here with the hurricane and the tropical storms. There is a process in play right now where we're starting to think about how we're going to do the extratropical storms. One of the problems is that we here at the National Hurricane Center, we focus on hurricanes. That's our specialty. But there is no agency within the National Weather Service that just does extratropical storms. So we have to kind of figure out a little bit of a paradigm shift of how we would handle that. And there are slightly different models that are used to forecast extratropical storm surge because of the structure of those storms. So the short answer is yes. The longer answer is it's still going to be a couple of years out before we get to that stage, but our hope is to be able to produce those same sorts of inundation graphics and heavy storm surge warning for extratropical storm surge events.
And I think we will wrap it up there on behalf of Ava Jean, myself, and all our participants. Robbie, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing this information. And we wish you continued success with your efforts there at the National Hurricane Center. And we wish you a quiet hurricane season.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Folks, before you go, please do take a moment to provide feedback and enter any additional comments you may have. You can click on the link in this slide to access the form. I fixed it. Hopefully it's working now. But it may actually open behind your fuse window, so you may have to take a look for it. Our next program will be June 11th, when we are pleased to welcome back the ever-popular Doc Lumpkins, who will be providing an update on the activities of the National Integration Center, where he is now serving as director. Until then, thanks to everyone for participating today. Thank you for your good questions. We hope you have a great afternoon. We are adjourned. Thank you, everyone.